From the Office of Student Research at Roosevelt University, this is The Theory Club. All right. Hello, Emily. How you doing?
Doing good, hanging in there, but enjoying my summer.
Good. Welcome, everybody listening to this very special episode of The Theory Club. I feel like I probably say very special every time, but this one's really special.
I think so.
So don't click away, because this one's exciting. Today, we're going to have a conversation about Amy Beach, who... what is there to say? There's so much to say about her. She's great. She's controversial. Her music speaks volumes to the way that the American sound has developed. And she has a very special place in my musical progression, because she was the first female composer that I sang. So I have this interesting attachment to her. And then you read more about her and you're like, oh, there's a lot going on. There's a lot going on here. And we're going to talk about Amy Beach with Miss Megan Lyons. How are you, Megan?
I'm good. I'm so excited to be here. I'm a huge fan of the podcast. So this is a kind of a dream come true. I'm not going to lie. So.
Oh my God. Thank you so much for being on. I literally, this season we've been talking about female composers, we've been talking about women theorists and anybody in music theory, musicology, and composition who are women, and we've just happened to talk about a lot of American women specifically. And so we've also had women guests on this season, and so in thinking through like who are we gonna invite on the podcast, we got to get some awesome women for the pod. And then I saw on the SMT pod site that you had studied Amy Beach, and I was like, that would be perfect to talk about Amy Beach with Megan. So I was just like, this is gonna be everything. So thank you again for being on the podcast. We're really excited to have you.
Thank you, guys.
So let's start with a bit about your background. So how you started doing classical music, your performance experience, when you decided to do music academia and music theory, and how all of that came about. Just tell us everything.
Sure. So I'll start with, I grew up on Long Island. So apologies if the accent comes out. It's, words like coffee, still can't get over it. Maybe one day I will.
What? I'm sorry.
Coffee, dog. I will unlearn at some point, but
coffee. I literally was like, oh, that's your sort of Long Island slang term, coffee. I was like, I don't, what does that mean? Hip? Is that what the kids are saying? But you literally meant coffee. Oh my goodness.
I did. Yes, it is. It is quite sad. My students always don't believe me that I'm, from Long Island until I say coffee or dog, and they say, oh my gosh, Megan, what happened? I started taking piano lessons when I was probably in first or second grade. My family wasn't all that musical, but they valued the arts, which I've always appreciated. But then in third grade, I wanted to pick up the flute. So I was faced with a choice, piano or flute. I chose flute. I was not the best at piano. I'm not the most coordinated human. Anybody who knows me can attest to that. I fall all the time. I'm very clumsy. So anything with two hands separate, probably not the best. Flute, two hands together, I got it. So I started playing flute, and I was pretty good. I mean, I was one of those kids. I picked up on it pretty naturally, and I really enjoyed flute, and I really enjoyed my music program growing up. Shout out to Harbor Fields Central School District on Long Island. And they really fostered my love of flute. And in high school, I was actually really split between what I wanted to do in my life. I was good at music, but I wasn't really sure how to have a career in music. I really only knew about performing. So I thought, okay, I could be a performer. But then at the same time, I was very into math and science. So I also wanted to be a biomedical engineer. So I had to let one of those go. So I ended up choosing music. And actually, I wanted to go into performance because that's all I knew. I took some theory classes and I thought it was fun, but I didn't know that I could have a career out of it. So I decided to go to the University of Delaware for my undergrad. And I started out as music performance, and I think I switched to music education like the first day of classes. I think I realized pretty quickly that I was not cut out for performance, not in terms of talent. You know, it's something I think I've heard Leah say before with, you know, the opera performing. Like, I thought I was, you know, I enjoyed playing, I was doing well, you know, I won competitions, but it was so toxic. You know, like I think there are certain instruments people will say there are like divas, or, you know, they'll break your instrument, things like that. And that's not my personality. I don't like being mean.
Wait, I'm sorry. Do they say that about flute players? Like,
yes. All the time.
Everyone in the upper range of any instrument, it's always those.
Yes, that's it. It's like sopranos, violins, flute.
It's like a translation from soprano. So like whoever's like the highest voice part is like a diva. That's
yes.
The first violin. Yeah.
That's the patriarchy at work. That's some internalized misogyny. Anyway.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It was, I mean, I will admit, were there some divas I met? Sure. Were all the other flute players I met really awesome? Yes. I loved everybody that I met. But yeah, it just wasn't for me. So I switched into music education. But after my first year, I was really loving my theory classes because I'm a giant nerd. I love puzzles. I love like mind games. I'm a huge escape fan, escape room fan. I have gone to probably 20 escape rooms. Highly recommend if you have not done an escape room.
I really
it's like music theory in a room.
I've never done one. Oh.
Oh,
he's
Lydia,
like theory in a room. Wow.
It basically is. I mean, at some point, Lydia, I will fly to you. We'll do an escape room.
But everybody party in Ann Arbor. I just moved. Let's do it.
So like, I guess, I don't know. My brain, I love puzzles. I love figuring things out. I used to love like books. I would analyze the heck out of a book. I would try to figure out the ending like two pages in. I mean, so I really started to like music theory, and my professors at Delaware were like, you know, you can major in this, like you can do this. And I was like, oh, okay. I did not know that. So I ended up double majoring music education and music theory because anybody who knows me also knows I am very indecisive and I like doing everything. I like having my hand in a million different places at once. So I didn't want to give up music ed. And I also felt that, and this is not a knock to any theory professors or especially anyone at Delaware or any of the schools I attended, I just felt that some collegiate professors in the music field didn't have an education background. They had an amazing amount of knowledge in theory or history or whatever, but I felt like they weren't trained as a teacher also. And again, no one in particular. I loved everyone that I got to work under, but I was determined to be a teacher first and then a theorist. And I know that's controversial. And
oh,
I know.
No, we feel the pedagogy building. We feel it building. It is. I mean, again, I think we're talking internalized misogyny here because we associate teaching with being more feminine as opposed to research being more masculine. And so I was just listening to one of my favorite podcasts, No Stupid Questions, through the Freakonomics Radio. And, you know, they had this episode that they put out called Why Is Academic Writing So Bad, right? This, like, because it's so dry and dense and it can be difficult to read and understand and comprehend. And there are lots of moving parts to that as far as, are there incentives for that writing to be bad, right? Like, I don't know if you've experienced this, Megan or Emily, when you're writing something and you want it to be clear and concise because it's educational, and someone criticizes you for that, for your writing being clear as opposed to loaded with a bunch of academic jargon under all of this language and prose that makes it seem complicated, but actually it, like the research might be sound, right? The fundamental ideas that you're exploring might be sound, but the way you have to present it has to be in this like in this really confusing, clouded, coded way.
Exactly. I'm so glad someone else has experienced this, because I am notorious for being able to get my thoughts across, get something down in writing in like two sentences that, you know, Mr. Smith, you know, down the hall would write 20 pages on. And I guess that's, you know, I don't know if that's a curse or a blessing to me. I think that's why it makes me a better teacher, because I can, you know, really get to the root of what I want to talk about. But I think that'll also bite me in the butt with my dissertation, because those can't be two pages. So might have to expand a little.
Sure. But anyway, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Continue.
No. I'm so glad we're talking about pedagogy, because, you know, it's true. I really wanted to be a teacher first and then a researcher, because, you know, what am I doing in my day-to-day life? You know, Monday, Wednesday, Friday morning, I'm hanging out with my favorite kids in, you know, Harmony 1, 2, 3, and 4. I got to teach them all. And that's what I'm doing on a day-to-day basis. My research, super fun, really rewarding. But, you know, I'm impacting other people's lives very directly. So I wanted to be a good teacher first. So that's why I kept my music ed as one of my majors. And then after Delaware, I really knew I wanted to get into the theory field. So I went and I got my master's at Hunter College in the City University of New York system. And once again, I was indecisive. I, of course, majored in music theory, but I wasn't really ready to give up flute yet. I was a really avid performer at Delaware. I played in a ton of concerto competitions, played with orchestras. So I majored in flute performance too, because I was like, you know what? Why not? It kind of made me.
So you got more... two masters, one in flute performance and then one in theory?
Yeah, I think, I don't know if it's technically two or just two like concentrations, but I did double dipped, I guess you could say.
Wow.
Yeah, I honestly, part of me, it's indecisive, but the other part of me is I am really adamant that I think being well-rounded, even within the music community, makes you better in whatever you end up concentrating in. So like, I think I'm a better theorist because I'm also a good performer. And because I also have that education background, like, I think that all contributes together. So I didn't want to like pigeonhole myself into one thing. So to someone looking at my resume in the job search next year, yes, I look chaotic, but it has all helped contribute to where I am today.
Wow, amazing. And now you are at UConn.
Yes, go Huskies. I am at UConn now. It is going to be my fourth year here. I am ABD. For anybody listening, that's all but dissertation. So I have completed all my coursework. I took my comprehensive exams, which were like 2 months of lots of crying and writing. And I've written my dissertation proposal, which got accepted. And that dissertation is on the art songs of Amy Beach, among many other things of Amy Beach. But yeah, so I'm in my final year here at UConn. I will be going on the job market for, you know, a fall 2022 start. So hire me, anybody out there.
This whole podcast has been a paid sponsored ad by Megan Lyons.
Yes, basically.
Thank you for sharing all that. I'm really interested in, so you mentioned that you have been teaching aural skills specifically.
Oh, the written harmony. We separate it here. So students have ear training 2 days a week. So Tuesday, Thursday, I think. I could be wrong about that. It might be Monday, Wednesday. My UConn kids will get mad at me for this. And then harmony is written harmony 3 days a week, Monday, Wednesday, Friday mornings.
Written harmony. Got it. Is there something about written harmony that is more attractive to you to teach, or do you have a preference for one over the other, or one that you think is more interesting research-wise?
I wouldn't say one interests me more than the other. I kind of got assigned to teach this. I'm not going to complain. I enjoy it very much. But the two really go hand in hand. You know, I find In my classroom, I'm not the best piano player, but we sing a lot. I'm also not a good singer, but that's okay. It encourages my students who also may not be confident to sing with me, because I always tell them you can't sound worse than me, so don't worry. But I think the two just go so hand in hand. You know, like we really communicate a lot between the ear training and the harmony teachers to make sure that what's happening in one classroom really enhances the other, because I know at some other schools, it's all in one. I think it's, you know, like 5 days a week, you're really mixing the two, oral based and written based together. And I mean, ideally, I think that's what I would love, because I don't like all the separation between things, but you know, I can't be in charge. So,
okay. That's interesting, because so that is the model that we use at Roosevelt, where I just graduated from and where Emily is going to be a sophomore. Emily, do you like it? Do you have any impressions of like, this is confusing, I would prefer there to be some separation, or
honestly, like thinking about it more, like stepping back and looking at it, I'm glad that they're together, because I like to see that connection, especially taught by the same professor, you know, doing both. I didn't like it at the beginning because I was like a pro in written skills and had zero experience in oral skills. So like the first 30 minutes of class, like I was literally like panicking and like scrambling and totally lost and like making a fool of myself trying to answer questions. And then the second half of class, I was like kind of sitting there almost like, okay, like I'd pick it up really quickly. So it was a weird combination at the beginning. But now that I'm kind of like, I have both kind of centered, and like, I think theory two is around where I'm like, okay, I can see connections between the two. I like it this way. And plus, as Dr. Hussey would say, he says a day without theory is a day without love. Technically, you're still doing theory every day. But like a day without RL skills for me, because I've grown to love it, is a day without love. So that'd be sad.
I'm so glad you brought up like how your strengths can be different too, because I was the exact same way in my undergrad. Super strong in written. RL skills, not the best, you know. I tried, but I think it's important, you know, for all music students to understand, like, you can be strong in one or the other and you will get there eventually. I know for me, it didn't connect until I started tutoring or teaching it, because and I could always talk about this later. I'm a big proponent of you don't really understand something until you teach it. So I make my students teach each other or teach me a lot, because you finally get it once you have to, you know, explain it to somebody else.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I was definitely the opposite coming into my theory sequence. Yeah, I was very, and I mean, that might have to do with, because I was a singer, am a singer, but I switched very quickly in my first semester, or just before I started my first semester, I switched from viola to voice. So I guess maybe that's because I had like a couple semesters of choir in high school, but I felt developed on sight singing and things like that, and the ear, like interval training and harmonic training for the ear went pretty smoothly. And then my first semester of written skills, it was like, okay, we need to slow down for a moment. What's going on here? But by the end of the first semester, I was kind of up to par on both. But that's interesting, because I loved that my sequence was separate. I loved having, okay, these days, I know what to expect. I kind of could like wire my brain to like, today's a written skills day, or today's an oral skills day. And that might have to do with the fact that the same professor taught both, right? So he was obviously on the same page with himself about, okay, how do we connect what we're learning here to what we covered yesterday and blah, blah, blah. So, but I don't know, it seemed to make so much sense the way that he structured both courses, to where I guess I'm just biased and saying like, no, I want two separate classes, but I can see how it could be difficult to kind of coordinate amongst multiple grad students, like, hey, this is what we're doing in this class, this is how that connects to this other class, you have a different teacher. Like, I can't imagine having a different teacher every semester, or every, you know, for like eight different grad students. Like, that would be probably a bit disorienting. So
Yeah, I like the continuity of having, I mean, I'm lucky because the students I had for Harmony 1, I had all the way through Harmony 4. So like they are my children. You know, I am their mother now. Like I'm very possessive. I love them a lot. And the ear training here is actually taught by one professor, Dr. Goldberg. He is a saint. He does all the ear training for everybody, which is insanity. I mean, he does.
Wow.
Yeah, he does ear training 1, 2, 3, 4, everybody forever. So God bless his soul, because that's a lot.
I mean, that's going to be Emily, since she has such a big interest in oral skills. Hey. That's going to be her future career.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
Grad students can handle the written stuff. And then Emily's I've got this. Back off.
I did not even get a chance to tell you this, Lydia, but literally daily over the summer, I have been doing oral skills, not much written skills, surprisingly, but just to keep my oral skills up. I learned all the chords that we're doing in Theory 3, because Dr. Hussey, I don't know if he knows, but like we can access Aurelian Musician for Theory 3, his course specifically. So I was doing that. And so I think I'm
the secondary dominance. We're talking the Neapolitans. We're talking the augmented six chords.
The augmented six chords. Now they're in harmonic dictations, and then we're modulating the distantly related keys and melodic dictations, and I'm getting it. I'm coming for Dr. Hussey this year. You don't even
watch out.
I really, Dr. Hussey, if you're listening, you don't need a grad assistant. You just need to give Emily the money. Like, I don't, it's not complicated. I know she's not a grad assistant. It doesn't matter. Like, we just need to give Emily the scholarship. So petition to give,
I mean,
to start the GoFundMe for Emily's education, for her to be upgraded to a grad assistant now, because she's already in it. She's doing it. Yeah, let's transition to discussing. And so I'm curious, Megan, how did you decide on your dissertation topic going to be Amy Beach?
So for me, maybe I'm an odd person, but I had a lot of trouble picking a dissertation topic. Maybe it comes back to my indecisiveness and loving to do anything and everything in music. But I was trying to find a balance between like all my interests. So I kind of have a few different research paths that I've been on. I work on the music of Joni Mitchell with my advisor. He just retired from UConn, Peter Kaminsky. We're writing a book on her. So I kind of had a little bit of singer, songwriter, you know, feminist music in that sort of camp. I also am really into corpus studies and like coding music. I've done some like literally like coding on the computer and music workshops. So I was like, maybe I can incorporate that. So I was just trying to figure out like, what could I do that's going to make me happy and that's going to incorporate all these different things. So I had heard some of Amy Beach's music, mainly, I think everybody knows like her Gaelic symphony, the piano concerto, you know, the violin sonata, her big hitters. But then I saw that she wrote art songs, and I was like, oh, okay, you know, I love art song, huge fan of, you know, Schubert. I mean, you know, that's the easy go-to, is everybody loves Schubert and his lead, but you know, he was the king of it. I'm gonna dethrone him at some point, maybe, but we'll see. she wrote a lot. So what I figured out is Victoria Malloway, she wrote a Music Theory Online, MTO article, doing a corpus study of some of Amy Beach's art songs. And it was about the form of the songs. It was like strophic form and, you know, how could she morph it in all these different ways? And it was super interesting. But I wanted to get into more of the text music relationship, because that's what I've really been studying with the music of Joni Mitchell also, is, you know, how does the text enhance the music and, you know, that connection. So I started looking into the art songs of Amy Beach, and I realized there's not really a lot of writing other than, you know, Victoria Malloway's article, which, you know, can be found online. And going further into that, I realized there were a ton of her art songs that kind of have been lost over the years. They're in some archives. There are two archives at University of New Hampshire and the University of Missouri, Kansas City. So I realized, like, wow, I can create a corpus. I can, you know, get some hard quantitative data from this, and I can analyze text and music. So it kind of all just fell into place. But if there's anyone out there who also was struggling with finding a dissertation topic like me, write down everything that you like, and then try to find something to fit that. Because I was kind of going about it the wrong way. I was thinking about, like, what's going to look good on the job market? Because everybody says that your dissertation, it has to be cool and new, but you can't do something too new because then no one's going to know what you're writing about. So once I stopped thinking about what everybody else wanted, I found something that I actually enjoyed. And, you know, I think, is it all that important? I don't know. I mean, we could go on some philosophical tangent of, is any music theory and musicology important? But, you know, I'm enjoying it. I'm learning a lot from it. I'm discovering a lot of things, a lot of hidden things about Amy Beach, which we can get into in a bit. But yeah, it's kind of everything all in one. So we'll see how it comes together.
Oh, that's so great. I'm so excited to read it. And yeah, you're really calling back to our episode with Dean Berna, the importance of finding the music and the tools that really inspire you and that speak to what you're interested in. Because if you do pick a topic that you're like, this is a marketable topic versus this is a topic that I actually have a lot to say about, or I think is interesting or relevant to me and my musical identity and experience. Yeah. You have to finish, right? Like, you
have to finish. That is the goal.
Right? Like, if you're just picking any old topic and something that has been written about a ton before, or is just something that you think is going to end up proving to be marketable in the job market, but then you end up struggling to finish because you can't find anything new to say about it, or because you end up hating the music or the tools or the language that you're studying, then that might ultimately defeat the purpose of you going to school to study the music that you like. So, you know, props to you for being able to figure it out. It is a difficult thing. People make it seem easy to pick a dissertation topic, but I think I also have a lot of different things and, you know, it's a couple years away for me, but I also have kind of a lot of different things. I'm like, oh, I could do this, I could do that. I don't, there's, you know, I love it all.
I feel like it's also, for me, I felt like I was judging myself against everybody else. You know, like, there's so many people, I knew people from their undergrad who already knew what their dissertation was going to be on, and they hadn't even gotten into a master's program yet. And I felt so behind, and I felt like inadequate. And, you know, finally, you know, my advisors here, everybody has been wonderful. My first year, they were like, just take classes, just explore, just have some fun, and then it'll happen. You know, I mean, yes, if I didn't have a topic by now, I'd be panicking, but I don't think anybody needs to pick a topic anytime soon if you're just starting out.
Some of this discourse when I was doing research for a project surrounding Florence Price and William Dawson and their symphonies. And I was getting into Dvorak's claims on the American sound and how that was going to be rooted in Negro melodies and stuff. And then, of course, Annie Beach had her infamous clapback, which was so cringy, it's unreal. I'm assuming in your research you've been encountering a lot of, you know, white women early 20th century nonsense. How have you been dealing with reconciling Amy Beach the person to Amy Beach the composer?
I feel like that's such a hard question, because I feel like it goes back to that sort of debate of, like, can you separate the composer and the music from the person? And I mean, for me, it's like, can you really do that when music is really like an outgrowth of that person? I mean, it's the same thing with like the whole Schenker debate or Wagner. It's like, can you really separate some like really, really problematic things that they said or did from their music? And for me, I mean, I take like Phil Ewell's lead, where he says, doesn't mean we're canceling somebody, but like, we need to talk about it. And especially, you know, getting into this whole Dvorak debate, there are two really big books on Amy Beach. So there's her really big monograph written by Adrian Block, came out in like the mid to late 90s. And then there was one by a guy whose last name is Jenkins, not the Danny Jenkins that we all know today, totally different guy from a while ago. But both of them really don't own up to the problems and the problematic things that Amy Beach did. And, you know, so that's going to be part of my dissertation, is really bringing some of this stuff out of the woodwork and saying, this was problematic. And I guess we should cue our listeners into what was so problematic. So the Dvorak thing that we're talking about stems from when Dvorak came over, you know, to the United States and said, I'm going to create the American sound. And I mean, from the start of that.
Already pause. Yeah, because it's like, okay, yeah, right. The fact that we can't ask Americans what the American sound is and should be and should develop into, and we need a white man from across the pond to come up, again, just going back to this fundamental concept of genius and who we consider to be a genius and an authority on these things and able to speak to these things, it just goes so far down. Like, it's just sorry, continue.
No, you're so right, because it's, I feel like every sentence we say, we're gonna have to be like, hold up, because every sentence just gets crazier. I mean, from the start, Dvorak being like, I'm going to do it, guys. I'm going to find the American sound. It's like, okay. I mean, you can help, I guess. But, you know, he wasn't from America. He didn't. I mean, he stayed here for a few years when he was developing the, you know, quote unquote, American sound. But I think immediately everyone was like, you know what? We're not going to be happy with this guy, especially they were the second New England school of composers. So Amy Beach was part of this. It included George Chadwick, the McDowells, Horatio Parker. They thought they were this, you know, cool group of six composers, and they immediately were like, nah, we're not for this Dvorak thing of defining the American sound. And I guess I should clarify what Dvorak defined as the American sound. He said it was essentially African-American spirituals, music, and also Native American music. And I will say, he did not use those terms. Let us just be clear. He did not use those terms. He was not being kind and, you know, I don't even want to say politically correct. He was not being correct when he was defining these cultures. Sure. But I will not go to his level. So immediately there was backlash to this. And, you know, I'm just going to be blunt about it. It was racist backlash. It was not people saying, oh, maybe it's more than just these two cultures creating our music. It was, no, it was people, including Amy Beach, saying, these people are not American. And I feel like we immediately have to just stop there, because it's like, what? Like, I mean, how did you guys feel when you were reading her coming back and saying, absolutely not, that, you know, these two cultures don't define America, they're too small of a population. I mean, it was, whew, I mean, we got to stop there and talk about it, because sure, that's already a problem.
Yeah, we see it all the time, kind of regurgitated and replicated in discourse today around representation politics, right? That listen, minorities in America, they're not represented on the big screen, in Hollywood, in music, proportionally for a reason. It's because the demographics of America are not proportionate. And so then the representation of, like, in media and in social spaces is going to reflect that, which is ludicrous. That's just insane. So, you know, she is kind of hitting on that same rhetoric as far as, like, listen, they're just too small a population for their songs to be truly American. I can't identify with their experience, and I'm an American, so they just must not be American, is the conclusion, which is so hostile and ridiculous. It's just, oh, like a knife to the heart. And again, it's a difficult truth to wrestle with, and it's easy for people to spin that into, I guess we just need to cancel her, which is not really what I propose needs to happen. It's like you said, we literally, the bare minimum and the first step is acknowledgement.
And I think for me, the part, because people have tried to, you know, cover up sometimes what she said and be like, oh, that's not what she meant. But when you read further into her argument, she said that
that's exactly what she meant.
Her argument was not only against that being the American sound, but she thought that it should be European and Civil War songs only, which, I mean, let's just be blunt, that's white. That is a white sound that she wanted. So, I mean, there's no other way around it. Yes, she may not have said something so overtly racist, but she was racist, flat out. I mean, Emily, how did you feel when you saw, you know, what she had written?
Well, I found it kind of interesting. Another example, this happens, like how you said, with Wagner and Schenker as well. Like, I never performed her music, but I've definitely heard about her, read about her, heard her music being performed, and just, like, I never really heard about her so-called, like, dark side, you know? Like, it's not until, like, I read this, or, like, I think, Lydia, like, your research stuff that we talked about before, like, that was when I actually came across, like, the darker side of composers that people, like, brush off. And so, I mean, it's unfortunate, you know, that, like, I knew about a composer for so long and, like, heard her music for so long, but, like, it was never, I never came across anything that, you know, she, like, explicitly said those things.
The part that also, like, bugs me about this whole thing is people do quote her. I don't know if it's from this response in particular, I don't have it up, but at one point she wrote, I think it was this response to Dvorak, that no composer should be composing with the musics of a culture if they're not part of it, which is the most hypocritical thing this woman could have ever said. So she was basically saying, well, Dvorak, you're, you know, neither African American nor Native American, so why are you, you know, basically appropriating their music? Which, I mean, fair point, but Amy, honey, you did the same thing. So for our audience, just so that they know, it says she wrote 30 compositions inspired by Scottish, Irish, Balkan, African American, Native American, Eskimo. I mean, like, the list goes on and on. And of course, she didn't use any of the proper terminology for these cultures. So let's not forget that either. But just the hypocrisy. And she even wrote one of her art songs, which is almost never referenced because it was published without an opus number. So it kind of gets lost in the mix. It's called On a Hill. And it's based on, guess what? A spiritual that she called out Dvorak for doing. So for me, it's so hypocritical. And that angers me almost as much. Well, not almost as much. I can't be angered more than the blatant racism, but, like, come on, girl. Like, you're such a hypocrite.
Mm-hmm. There are ways that leaning into that distinct brand of American pride just breed this, right? Yeah, this hypocritical, egotistical rhetoric that really harms a lot of communities of color, and does more damage to women, even though she was a white woman. So it's just,
I mean, I will say this is, this isn't like totally out of character for her, because she was kind of also hypocritical in, I mean, there hasn't been a formal argument either way, but she was kind of a feminist, but also said she was not a feminist. So like, for example, she would call out reviewers for saying, oh, it was good, like for a woman, or, you know, anytime they questioned her being a female composer, she got pretty mad about it and said, it shouldn't matter my gender, you know, I'm a composer, or blah, blah, blah. But then when people would say, oh, so you support equality and feminism, she'd be like, nah, no, I don't. So it's the same issue of like, what are you doing? I mean, I always try to, when I talk about Amy Beach with my class, I try to say, listen, she was both privileged and also, you know, had her struggles. She was a white woman who was forced to marry a guy 35 years older than her when she was 18. So like, yeah, did she have some struggles? Of course. But she was also a white woman in Boston. Her family had money. So like, you know.
Yeah. And I mean, it's, that's the thing about being a female composer, or being a woman in music, or a woman in academia, is that you're always towing this line of, because you have to conform to the preconceived and biased concept of genius, you get rewarded for doing the white man thing well. And that's how you stay in the room. And so she had to navigate, oh, I really strongly identify with womanhood, but I also kind of have to reject womanhood in order to stay in the game, in the room with the quote unquote big dogs, right, of the early 20th century. You know, she had to publicly come out against feminism, because aligning herself with feminism could very well have come at the detriment of her career. So it's like, true. You can be a woman, but like not too woman, right? Like there's a limit. And I'm sure,
well, yeah,
that we've all kind of felt that similar pull in academia.
Well, it's true. Her, you know, her group, the second New England School of Composers, I think it was like after her Gaelic Symphony, because that was kind of her really big moment where the world started to know. They said, oh, now she's one of the guys. And like, it's such a simple statement. And I'm sure like the intention was a compliment and like, you're our bud sort of thing. But to me, I was just like, wow, that's gross. Okay.
That's gross. Don't do that. If you're listening and you're a man, which, hi, thanks for listening. A lot of our audience are men. It's more men than women, which is interesting.
Really?
Yes.
It's like, fascinating.
It's like 65% men, which is really interesting to me. So if you're a man listening to this, hi, thank you for listening. Don't call me one of the bros. Don't, right? Like, don't call me the mom in the room. How about just don't give me a gendered nickname? Let's do that. Thank you.
Right? There are so many non-gendered things that they could have said at that moment. I mean, they also had a name for their little group. So, I mean, there is no need to bring it back to gender. But yeah, I mean, I just, the whole idea of like Beach as racist, Beach as feminist, it's like, she's very hypocritical. I mean, there's also, if anyone out there is curious, there's a, I'm not sure if it's a dissertation or a master's thesis, that was written arguing that Amy Beach might have been on the spectrum for autism because of her history. Not that that would excuse any behavior, but I thought that was an interesting argument because of her. She was like oversensitive to sound, like any sorts of sound could like set her off. She was, her social cues were not the best. So there were just some things that could have pointed in that sort of diagnosis, which obviously no one was diagnosing autism back then. But I just thought that was an interesting argument. Not that that would excuse anything that she said, but that could maybe explain, you know, why her mind could sometimes be in like multiple places.
Interesting. I've actually never heard that. We'll have to do a whole episode on autism and music studies and composition and performance and stuff like that, because there's so much interesting research around, like, you know, like Glenn Gould and other people who are on the spectrum and have like superb musical abilities and talent, and whether that's like exploitative or like, you know, it's interesting. I've never heard that she might be on the spectrum. Okay, good to know. Let's transition to talking about her song After. I had actually never heard this piece, so thank you to Megan for introducing it to us. Is there something, Megan, in particular that attracts you about analyzing art song? Because we talked about this in a different episode with Dr. Linda Berna, that she had a chapter in her dissertation analyzing an art song, and that there can be criticism around, oh, that's just a two-page song and it's not worth an in-depth analysis. We also talked a lot in that episode about the music-text relationship, and I know you mentioned that earlier. So is there something in particular about that that you just really gravitate towards?
I think it's because I did not have the benefit of text as a flute player. I always wished I had a little more insight into what was happening in the song. It was always fun taking flute lessons in undergrad. My professor, Eileen Gursky, she and I would come up with a song and lyrics for whatever I was playing. A lot of times it had to do with like a love story, or my imaginary boyfriend was breaking up with me, something like that. And it it helped create like a picture, and you know, it helped me realize, oh, here's an interesting harmony, or oh, this is a really interesting repeating motive that I need to alter every time, you know, things like that that I didn't realize because I was just like, oh, it's notes. I'm playing notes on a page. So for me, seeing text, it just kind of, it gives like a whole new level to everything, because it's, you know, the text music relationship is like, it is truly like 50-50. I mean, you have to look at both really in depth. You're kind of almost analyzing it like poetry, like you're an English major sometimes.
Yeah. Emily, do you ever like make up narratives for like your music? Because I never did that when I was a violist, but you know, I never studied at the collegiate level, so like I just never really, I might have gotten into that later, but do you, like, I don't know, that's interesting to me.
Yeah, so yes is the short answer. It's interesting, like once I really got to like know a piece, like just really well, like it was already memorized, like I was getting ready to perform it, it was at that point where I would literally set a story to it to distract me from like letting my mind go everywhere else, but also to help bring out the music. So that did work for me. But then as for putting like actual text with the notes, I had two teachers in high school, and my second teacher that I had, he would always do that. He would literally, like when he was trying to get me to phrase something, he would just sing like something for a love song, like I love you, or this is, and like, oh, this whole story would keep going. My current teacher, actually, Mrs. Vamos, does do that too. Now that I'm thinking about it, she will like, so she did make like a whole story. I had a bit of a breakup in like January this past year, and she happened to ask me a few weeks after it, like, oh, you know, this part is kind of like, you know, losing someone you love. Have you ever lost someone you love? And I was like, well, yeah, a few weeks ago, like my boyfriend and I split. And she was like, oh, that's horrible. Here. And she comes up with this whole thing. She's playing the violin and like singing these lyrics, like, oh, he's horrible, I hate him. And like, she's crazy. But yeah, also another thing though, I would use those lyrics that like my high school teacher would like just toss in from memory, because if I was having memory issues, sometimes it wouldn't help to think of like the fingering or the note name or something, but to like think of the funny lyric or something that would, I could associate with it, I would do that. But for some reason, like I don't feel totally like connected with text, like set in stone text with music, because I've had like no actual experience with it. I've come up with my own random stuff, but like, you know, I don't have like experience with that. Yeah, I like the mystery. I just get like black dots on a paper and I figure it out.
So now we are going to take a moment to listen to Amy Beach's After, Opus 68. cannot believe I've never heard this song before.
It is not one of her most famous, especially her art songs. She has two that are called Ecstasy. One is Extase in French. Those are her big ones. She has a couple of sets, you know, the Three Browning songs are a popular one. But this one is really not popular. I'll admit, it wasn't really on my radar until I was teaching enharmonic modulation to my Harmony 4 class, because this goes to some interesting places harmonically, I will say that. But yeah, I guess we should start by talking about the poem. That's how I always advise people. You know, we got the text and the music, so let's talk about the text. I'll read it just so that our audience can keep up with us. So it's called After, and the poet is Florence Earle Coates, who was one of Beach's favorite poets, I will say that. After the darkness dawning and stir of the rested wing, fresh fragrance from the meadow, fresh hope in everything. After the winter, springtime, and dreams that flower-like throng. After the tempest, silence. After the silence, song. After despair and doubting, a faith without alloy, God here and over yonder, the end of all things, joy. So kind of sounds like a riddle. I feel like a troll under a bridge giving somebody a riddle.
I did have to look up alloy and a few other words. I was like, hmm?
She loves the old English, I will say, especially text-wise. She said a few of, this is a tangent, but she said a few of her songs to her husband's poems, which were, I'm so sorry, Dr. Beach, they were horrible. He loved saying like really old English sort of things like ye over here and, you know, thou arts and things that were very done by, you know, the early 1900s. So not sure why he was so into it. But anyway, yes, she uses a lot of old timey kind of words. But I feel like this poem in particular is kind of like a riddle. Like you have to figure out what is after almost. Mm-hmm. So I was curious because I've decoded this to no end. So I'm curious, what do you guys think after means?
Oh God, don't ask me. I'm gonna make a fool out of myself.
No. I genuinely don't think there's one answer. I have like a theory, but I'm curious, like from a clean brain, what someone thinks.
Yeah, I mean, what comes to mind when I was listening to it a couple times, it really reminds me of, you mentioned the Browning songs, she tends to have this theme of exploring nature and connecting it to love and stuff. So it's this whole like, oh, you know, there's silence and then there's song and there's after the winter, there's spring and there's, right? So the whole dynamic order of how like God structured the world, right? This overarching theme of what comes after faith, what comes after God is kind of where it ends in this whole like the thing that's really puzzling to me. Yeah, the end of all things joy at the end. It's like, oh wait, did we just take like a turn into, so where I'm struggling to kind of interpret where she meant to land the plane, I suppose.
I will say that the punctuation of the poem that Beach uses is different than the actual punctuation. So the poet intended it to be the end of all things, M dash joy. So like joy is the end of all things. Yeah. Oh. Which is, it's a big difference. So currently I'm going back and forth because obviously the poet, because I looked at her like original, you know, handwritten sort of thing. And there's a big dash being like the end of all things, M dash joy. But then when Beach said it, she got rid of that. But I will say that my interpretation of this is that after is heaven, like the afterlife. So like you go through life and there's, you know, your trials and tribulations or whatever. And the end of all things, the end of your life, joy is heaven. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, could there be a million other interpretations? Yes, 100%. The only reason I feel like this fits is because she was so religious.
Oh, sure. Yeah, no, it makes a lot of sense, especially all of the kind of triplets leading into this like climactic ending, it's very reminiscent of the years at the spring. So it's like, oh, you know, all's right with the world. It's like, bum, 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 just all the triplets. It's like, oh, okay, yeah, dandy is the ending. So that makes a lot more sense, because I was like, oh, the end of joyful things? Like, we're all destined for destruction? I don't know if that's what she meant, but...
Emily, is that the way you also took it? Because when I first heard it, I was like, oh my god.
Like, I was like, oh, this is like a scathing take on like capitalism, right? Like the end of the destruction of all of us. Like, okay, Miss Beach, okay.
No, I mean, yeah, I'm a Catholic too, and like that's immediately kind of how I took it. It was just that last line that was kind of confusing, because it made it seem, I was like, huh, that's what threw me off then, because saying like no joy almost, I'm like, wait, how does that work? But understanding that part now with the dash, okay, then yeah, I would 100% go for it being something related to faith and like the afterlife.
It's interesting, because obviously in all my research I've been really looking into Beach and her religion, and she wasn't really religious growing up. She was kind of I don't want to say transient, she was very fluid with her family between different churches and different denominations. Like one of her parents was Baptist, the other was Calvinist. They went to an Episcopal church, I think. I mean, they were kind of all over the Protestant map. But right after her husband died, and this song was written right before her husband died, but right after her husband died, her mom died. And then she got super into the church. So I think religion kind of played a bigger part in her life than most people want to see in the connection. So. Some of the things I have my students look for when we're analyzing art song is there's kind of two levels, I like to call it, of the text music relationship. There's text painting, and then there's kind of like the bigger picture, which I've kind of been calling music charades lately, because it's kind of like you got to figure out what the heck is happening in the music. So Emily, do you know anything about text painting?
I do not.
Okay, so text painting is kind of really small details, like a really small scale. So like, for example, if I told you, how can I represent in the music the trumpets sounding taps, what would you say? Like, how could you put that into music?
Oh geez.
Think very literally. I should say, do you know what taps are? Because not everybody knows what taps are, and that's an unfair question.
Oh, well, I guess not then.
Taps are, if you've ever been to like a Memorial Day parade or a military funeral where they have the trumpet doing the brr, 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 like the...
Oh, wait, okay. Yes, I've heard of that before. Okay.
Yep. So, for example, in Amy Beach's After, she at one point in the poem, it says the trumpet sounding taps. So what could you kind of expect the music, what would you expect to hear in the music if the text is telling you trumpet sounding taps?
Trumpet sounding taps.
Exactly. Okay. It seems like such a trick question, because I asked my students the same thing and they were like, I don't know. And I'm like, it's very literal. So that's what text painting is. It's like, I'm taking the text and I'm going to just make it really literal. Like, I'll do another example. What if the text said up and down? What, if you were a composer, what could you do with your melody?
Well, the pitch would go up and then it would go down.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And that's what text painting is. It's like these like super like little fun moments in the music. There are some other good ones, like Stir of the Rested Wing. The music starts to pick up after that. Or at one point in the text, it said silence, and then there was a rest, and both the voice and the piano rested. So there's these like very small scale local moments where it's like, ah, yes, I see the words, I hear the music, I make the connection. Now, the harder part is what I call these like music charades or beyond text painting, where it's kind of like a musical metaphor. So I'm not sure. I think people in the audience might be familiar, but there's the Schubert song, the Erlkönig, the Elf King. I'm not sure.
Oh my gosh. We are.
It's a classic.
It's honestly, because we literally recorded a whole episode on it, and it's like a lost episode because my audio got lost. So we didn't get to release it, but it was going to be like a bonus episode. And we literally recorded a whole episode on like different versions of the Erlkönig because there are so many. And, yes. You know, Emily pronounced it perfectly the entire time. So you know, it was amazing.
I make a fool out of myself like every single episode. I'm pretty sure everyone laughs at me and like...
I'm sure your German is better than mine. Don't worry. But I'm sure you guys know that piece super well. So like, there's the whole story, in case anybody in the audience doesn't know, it's like a narrative of a father and son riding a horse away from this like ghostly paranormal elf king sort of thing. But it starts out, if you know Mariah Carey's All I Want for Christmas Is You, that the triplets going really fast. There's a great combo of the two of those songs together. Highly recommend.
Wait, but really? Oh, I'm yes. Gonna find it. I'll throw it in at the end, listeners. Oh boy.
But that's a moment that I would call like a musical metaphor or beyond text painting, because when you hear that da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, if you assign that to a character, you could think of that like as the horse. You could think of that that's like the horse galloping. So those are the other kind of moments that I like look for in these art songs, is there something that's bigger scale, maybe that the text isn't labeling it, but you know, the idea, the theme of the poem is like alluding to it. So like, for example, in After, there's a few moments where we have like arpeggios, you know, we have these like soaring lines going up. And to me, all I can think about is like, okay, if After is heaven, maybe these moments are ascending to heaven, or what I've been kind of calling it, like transcendence. So it's difficult because the text painting on a small scale, like there's, you know, there's right and wrong. There's, yep, that's a horse galloping, or oh, that's going up and down. But these beyond text painting moments are really cool because, you know, talking to different musicians, theorists, everybody finds something new in these songs. Everybody finds something where they're like, wow, this is the idea of the poem embodied in the music. And it's, you know, this metaphor, basically.
I really, really love the way that she uses rhythm and the melody in the song. It's like always coming in, not quite on one, but it's like coming in on ties, on the third beat, and then it tying into the, or the, you know, the first phrase, you know, coming in on this, ah, da, da, da. It strikes me as so jazzy almost, the way that she never, you know, you're always on your toes, like, when's the next entrance? I don't really know. And I really like her, the way that she kind of subverts our expectations. I also, this is something that pops up in those Browning songs too. Her modulations are so seamless and amazing and so strategic. You know, as soon as she starts the new verse, it's like, all right, now you know it's the new verse because it's a new key. And she just does these great, like, common chord or like one note modulations, again making use of those suspensions and kind of subverting the beats. I just, it's brilliant to me. It makes for such a pleasing listening experience.
And I'm so glad you brought that up, because two things. One, you're so right. Every time she starts a new phrase, line, whatever of the text, it's always like off the beat, syncopated something. The first time it is on the beat, on a downbeat, is when she says God. And I feel like that just contributes to everything we've been saying. You know, all three of us are like, oh yeah, this is something with like heaven, God, something with faith. And it's like, well, the rhythm is agreeing with us. So, but also, yeah, I wanted to talk about these cool modulations because these are really tricky. My Harmony 4 kids really had to push to figure these out because they're enharmonic and they don't really make sense. So for example, we start off in D flat major, which gross, but she loves that in G flat major. So thanks so much, Amy. So we go from D flat major to E major, which doesn't really make sense. So if I gave those like Roman numerals, if I gave D flat a 1, what the heck would I give E?
Emily, quiz E question. What would we give E in the key of D flat? She's been practicing, listeners. She's been practicing.
Wait.
Emily.
Think of the number first. So like if D flat is 1, what number of a Roman numeral would we give to E?
2.
Perfect. And now, does E natural make any sense?
No.
No, exactly. So how did we get from E flat to E natural? What do we do to E flat to make it E natural?
Raise it a half step.
Exactly. So we can actually, as a Roman numeral, we can say D flat is 1 and E would be like a sharp 2, or, you know, like a natural 2, something really weird.
Oh, okay.
Right? Exactly. Like you figured it out. You just got to piece it together. So that doesn't really make any sense. Right. I mean, who modulates from 1 to 2 other than, obviously, I'm talking about like in the classical Western canon. We love, you know, pop and jazz. They would be able to handle this easily. But is there another thing, another label that we could give instead of sharp 2? Could we enharmonically label it another way that maybe makes a little more sense?
Flat 3.
Exactly. Look at you. So exactly, flat 3. Now, I feel like this is going to be a weird question, but like, why would she do E major? Why would she do sharp 2 instead of flat 3? Like, let's just think about it logically. What would flat 3 be in the key of D flat major?
Like an F flat.
Yeah.
Very nice.
Exactly. And I feel like this is why art songs, especially in this sort of era, you know, like romantic, you know, turn of the 20th century, these composers were going to what looked like super weird places. I mean, like D flat to E natural, come on. Like, who does that? But, you know, Emily just broke it down for us. It's really just flat 3, but a practical flat 3. Right. So a lot of our composers that, you know, people may study in Harmony 3 or Harmony 4, they're going to do this. And I'm just telling you right now, if you see one of these on your test, anybody listening, do not write sharp 2. Don't do it. Save yourself. Write flat 3.
Do you have any things that you want to make sure we get to? Any final thoughts?
Not really, other than just, I feel like art song is such a formal term and I feel like it's really intimidating to people, but in reality, it's any type of song. Like for me, studying Amy Beach is super similar to studying Joni Mitchell. They're both using their emotions, text and music, and it's working in this, you know, amazing symbiotic relationship where it comes out as a work of art. And now I'm not saying every song on the planet is an art song and there's these deeper meanings. Some of them are just for fun and that's cool. I mean, love me some Taylor Swift or whatever. Maybe it doesn't have as deep a meaning. I mean, actually, I can't even because her music videos are like on another level. But
I do stan Taylor Swift. I do quite like it. But yeah, I mean, I can totally see what you're saying as far as the way, and I mean, this is just how classical music functions, right? The way in which we formalized it through the process of analysis, it siphons us off from pop culture in a way that makes it inaccessible to a lot of people. So I can understand how the label of classical music of art song, right? And And that was deliberate, right? Because of elitism. Like, that was
absolutely
deliberate. Like, absolutely. We're going to separate ourselves from Elvis and Billy Holiday, right? Like, oh, we don't want to associate with, you know, the music of the youths. But, you know, that comes at the cost of classical music remaining relevant. And hopefully through podcast and through, you know, conversation and young people doing theory and the work of everyday theory professors, we can communicate or create a better space that's able to foster the conversations that the youths are having. So, I mean, that's why Emily's a part of this podcast, because, you know, I need someone to keep me young.
And I'm so glad you brought it up, because as a teacher, this was, so we had an art song unit, we had a singer-songwriter unit, and then the final thing I ever did with my Harmony 4 kids is we had an art song project. So basically what I wanted to do is make it more approachable, right? It's literally just text and music. So what we did is we said all students had to pick a poem or a text, you know, spoken word, something like that. But the poet had to be a woman or a poet of color somehow, or a combination of the two. Basically not a white guy, right? Like, let's just be real. We wanted not a white guy. And we challenged our students to pick some like hard-hitting topics. I mean, some people took Amanda Gorman's The Hill We Climb. I think that was her spoken word for the inauguration this past January. So they set these poems. I mean, when I tell you the class was crying at basically everybody's compositions, I mean, there were a lot of tears shed, because it was just so beautiful to see. Not everybody, I should say, basically nobody wrote in a super classical format of, I have my period followed by a combined sentence sort of thing. It was pure art. And like, these kids really understood, they understood the assignment of, you know, relating the text to the music, because they had those little moments of text painting, you know, where maybe it talked about climbing a hill and they, you know, had the notes go up, but then some of them just painted these beautiful like stories with their music. So, I mean, that's a whole nother, I could go off about how amazing this project was, but it just, I think it showed them that art song doesn't just have to be like Schubert or Amy Beach. Like, it can literally just be somebody composing something with text and it being this beautiful piece of art at the end. So highly recommend that as a final project for people.
I want to do it.
Right?
It sounds interesting.
We are going to wrap it up for this episode of The Theory Club. Thank you so much to Megan for being on the podcast. This is so fun.
Thank you, guys. Oh my gosh, this was the highlight of my year, easily. Oh my gosh, this is so much fun.
If you are listening and you're like, wow, they just sounded like they had so much dang fun, and I wish that I was in Megan's shoes, I want to be the third co-host. You know, I hate to break it to you that has been filled by Megan, but if you want to be a fourth guest on the podcast, you can reach out to us at thetheoryclubpodcast@gmail.com. Follow us on the Instagram. It's thetheoryclub_podcast. And get in touch with us if there's something that you want us to talk about, a composer, you know, a theory, you know, anything like that. Let us know, and we might get to it. Other than that, we hope you enjoy your Friday and your weekend, and we'll see you next time. Bye. The listeners are going to petition for you to become like the third host of the podcast. They're going to be like,
no, I can't.
Megan's
live up
not
to
a
you
guest
guys.
Anymore.
No.
Megan's no longer a guest. Like, she is the host. Like, or I'm quitting.
I see like our Instagram, like hashtag Megan for season 3 or something.
Hashtag it. It's trending. Literally. It's already trending. I feel it in the ether. It's already trending. All right. Well.